Good morning, everybody. I'm Larry Jacobs, the Street Day 12 Education Officer. On the 7th of June 2020, it's a pleasure to have you here with us today. Or on the archives, we archive our shows at education-talkradio.org. That's education-talkradio.org. And we change our schedule every Saturday. And you can see that up there, and you can make your plans accordingly. And if you want to follow us on the Twitter, it's EduTalk Radio, and on Facebook, it's EduTalk Radio and Larry Jacobs, and on LinkedIn, it is Larry Jacobs. You can go over there, and we'll send you a link to every show as soon as we are done. We're also very proud of our equity and access website. That is ACE-ED.org, home of the American Consortium for Equity in Education. That's ACE-ED.org. We publish our magazine over there, Accessibility, Compliance, and Equity, which is also subtitled Equity and Access Pre-K-12, and we're very proud of that. It's a great magazine. We're putting the finishing touches on the June-July issue as I write, and it'll be up on site. It's an online journal. It'll be up on site, ace-ed.org, next week, and I'll be sure and keep everybody apprised of when that's happening. By the way, if anybody wants a subscription to that, you can certainly just write me at edutalklarry@gmail.com, edutalklarry@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to facilitate that. Everything is free over there at ace-ed.org. It's a consortium of educator and industry voice, and we want your voice heard. Please join with us. Again, it's all free, and we really want to hear what you have to say about equity and access in this age, if I may, of equity and access. All right, without further ado, let me bring on my guest, who is a returning guest. He's been on many, many times with us. He's a good friend of mine, Dr. Howie Knopf, although it's K-N-O-F-F. It's a silent K, Howie Knopf. Hello, Howie, all the way down in Arkansas. How you doing?
Good morning. How are you, Larry?
I'm just fine, my friend. What's going on in Arkansas these days?
We're still stuck at home, although some of my peers haven't figured that out yet, and so Arkansas is one of those top states still with the COVID-19, but, you know, we got to fight this virus and knock it out of the park.
Right, and we're doing our damnedest to do that, and I hope all those peers who are walking around unmasked and think this thing is over, I hope they are all well, okay, because they're really playing with fire there, and I say that to everybody, no matter where you are, please wear a mask. I just saw a thing on 60 Minutes. It was the gentleman who's the doctor who's in charge of bringing the kids back to the University of North Carolina, and he said, what's the most important thing? He said, masks, masks, and masks. Okay, so wear a mask and stay in when you have to, right, Harvey?
Absolutely. I'm sitting at home.
Good man. Pardon my scratchy throat for some reason. Howie's president of Project Achieve, Project Achieve Educational Solutions, worked with schools, districts, has been with us many times. Okay, he's past president of the National Association of School Psychologists. He knows what he's doing, and he tweets at Dr. Howie, K-N-O-F-F. Dr. Howie, K-N-O-F-F. It's pronounced, as I have learned over the years, with a silent K, enough. And we're going to talk about what's going on with systemic racism and inequity in our schools. And I'm just going to let you go with this one. George Floyd was murdered. We all had to watch that horror, 3-4 weeks ago now. Unbelievable. And, boy, that started something. And now we have to work with this. You know, we have the pandemic. We're stuck in the middle of that. And now we have the social justice movement. And I was talking to two wonderful superintendents, Lavelle Brown and Khalid Mumin of Ithaca, New York, and Reading, PA, respectively, a couple of days ago. And not only do they have to bring the kids back with the pandemic happening, but they really have to take a good look of how they're going to handle the social justice, i.e. the equity aspect of this. So, Howie, just talk about this, okay? How do the George Floyd murders reflect on the schools? Let's say it that way. Howie Knopf, everybody.
Well, you know, let's start with Mr. Floyd. I mean, just a horrific situation. Obviously, emotional reactions from everyone, really, across the country, indeed, across the world. But, you know, not to diminish his death, but he kind of has become the tipping point. He is another black gentleman in a long history in this country of police abuses, as well as getting into the history of, you know, of black slavery and so on, lynchings in this country for 400 years. So he's representative of an inequitable system. But our schools have been inequitable for basically the same period of time. And yes, I understand, you know, we had Supreme Court decisions in the 1950s. We had 1964 where schools were supposed to be integrated. And those were all positive steps. But the reality is in 2020, our schools are still racially inequitable. And
yep.
Part of the deal here, and I think this is the big picture for me, is that if our schools are not equitable, then all of us, but especially black children and adolescents, do not get the education that they want. They're not able to move into the jobs that they want. They end up in economic distress, and now we have the whole vicious cycle. And it's not that education is going to be the only way that we're going to stop this vicious cycle, but we've got to address it. And if George Floyd has now triggered a discussion about policing, I hope at the same time that his unfortunate death will re-trigger the reality that we've got to correct the inequities in our schools.
Well said, Howie. And this is an interesting point. I mentioned this on a show yesterday. With all the social with all the social protesting going on, Black Lives Matter, et cetera, and they're talking about policing, which I understand kind of is top of mind right now, all things considered these days. But I noticed that there hasn't been a lot of chatter. At least I haven't seen it nationally. Of course, I hear it every day doing this show and working with our consortium equity, et cetera, our equity consortium. Okay. But have you heard a lot of chatter about education with what's going on these days? I haven't, just generically across the board, not in terms of our professional side.
I mean, in a proportional way, no. I think CNN had a program about 2 weeks one evening about it and had some educators and school psychologists on there. But, you know, in the context of all of the discussions, no. And really the remediations have been so laser focused on police reform that the broader discussions and certainly the history of, you know, of slavery in this country, but the corollary effects have not been discussed.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The only way I've seen the schools discuss these past weeks, and we're going to get into detail on this, is I read that some schools are asking that resource officers be removed from the schools. Okay, that's kind of where I'm seeing some chatter. All right, but I'm not seeing the broad need. And again, everybody's concerned about bringing the kids back health-wise with the pandemic, but now we have to think about it social justice-wise. Okay, what the kids' expectations are, okay, regarding what's been happening all this summer, particularly kids of color. It's going to be a really different world, I think, in September, no matter how the kids come back. And, it's amazing. And we could talk about this philosophically about it, Howie, till we're blue in the face. But in reality, I said this to Goldie Muhammad, my good friend, I said we have to confront this racism. Okay, that's the part of the problem is that we brush it off. I was watching 60 Minutes this past weekend, and the Tulsa massacre, sadly closer to Arkansas than I am here in Maine, in 1921, where the city just went absolutely insane and carried out a pogrom, if I may, against the black neighborhood of Greenwood. You're not going to believe what I'm going to say if you didn't see that 60 Minutes thing. Tulsa schools never even taught that happened. It was never mentioned in Tulsa schools.
Yeah, okay. You know, I mean, tip of the iceberg in terms
this.
Of... Yeah.
Yeah, we got to confront
tip, absolutely. I mean, tip of the iceberg in terms of confronting this. And again, I want to be balanced, but I don't want to be balanced in a sense. I mean, you know, I've been working with the schools since, quote, school closed in March. Okay, I mean, I've been on.
And you're so old. That was March. That was March 1777, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, right. But you know, I mean, I'm on Zoom calls. I'm still doing my consulting. I've got three federal grants that were still running in Oklahoma. Coincidentally, Oklahoma, Michigan, and New Jersey. And so, I mean, schools have been just overwhelmed over the past 3 months with the pandemic, with trying to get education to the kids, with dealing with food for the kids, for the kids relative to the free lunch program, of trying to make sure that staff are prepared. And so they've been consumed with the pandemic. But let's take the pandemic just as one example, again, of inequity. What did we find at the very beginning of this whole process? Yes. We found that we've got lots and lots of kids from poverty, which includes lots of kids from minority, you know, backgrounds, who don't have computers at home, who don't have hookups in terms of internet or good quality internet, that are sharing one computer with four or five kids at home.
Do.
All right. So the inequity even of the pandemic, never mind the fact that African Americans have gotten, you know, COVID-19 more than others because most of them are in lower paying jobs and essential workers.
Right.
But the kids have been impacted also. And so the inequity of having access to virtual learning and then the inequity of a larger achievement gap because of it, that's been in our face. But again, our educators have been so consumed with just helping kids that they haven't had an opportunity to stand back and look at these broader issues, and I think that's true, again, of the country.
It really and truly is. And by the way, I want to mention also, since you were talking about people of color a minute ago, we have the same problem no matter what color in rural America, okay, where the kids do not have access, et cetera. So that inequity is across the board, though it probably affects low-income urban folks more than others, but it is affecting everybody across the country. So, Howie, okay, we got about 25 minutes left. In 25 minutes, can Dr. Howie Knopf of Project Achieve cure the world? What do you see? Where do we start with this? And I believe the start is confronting it, okay, and talking about what's going on and what's happening and getting the word out. I'll use an analogy. That's what they did in Germany. I don't know whether you know this, Howie, but in the first 10 years after World War II, the Holocaust and what happened to everybody, Gypsies, Catholics, Jews, because of the Holocaust, that was never mentioned in German schools. And finally, it was brought to light by German prosecutors in Frankfurt. And that's what changed it. They started to confront what they did in World War II, and that has made all the difference. And we have to start confronting things here. Okay, but there's got to be steps to do it. And I, like I said, confronting is the worst. But Howard, you want to go down some practical steps that maybe we can at least take a look at and raise the questions? I know we can't cure this in 24 minutes of show.
Yeah. Let me reference, as long as you're referencing the Holocaust, and I actually had that in my notes also. I mean, history repeats itself. So, you know, we have the Holocaust, which hopefully will never be repeated again, although in essence around the world it has. But let's remember again, in the United States, we've had the whole situation with the Japanese containment camps in World War II.
Yes, we do.
We've got our Native American brothers and sisters. I mean, the district that I'm working with in Oklahoma is almost half Native American. And, you know, I've worked in 15 different Native American communities across the country during my career. But let's go back to the history in Native American history of the boarding schools where, you know, back in the late 1800s. Okay. All right. And again,
they're
that's disgusting. Not to diminish the here and now in terms of the racism and the African American community.
No, it's part and parcel of how we handle things. We just ignore it. That's what you're saying. We can't ignore it anymore. Okay?
Right.
That's what you're saying. And by the way, you won't talk about Native Americans. We always think of kind of Oklahoma and, you know, other. But in New Mexico, the recent social protest that was going on to tear down that statue of that conquistador, Onante, I think his name was, and there was a It was a big thing. It was just yesterday. Okay, and today, by the way, is the 17th of June. The reason that was Native Americans, because he was like Adolf Hitler against the indigenous peoples of New Mexico when Spain took over. What he did to people in terms of torture, etc., and wiping out entire tribes, etc., is absolutely unbelievable. And the fact that this son of a bitch has a statue on a rock in Albuquerque is beyond belief.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's beyond belief.
Right. All right, so
you know,
let's
you look
get
at the
to
history
the
of that thing, if I may. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, that,
right.
Yeah. That's what
well,
we're,
but,
so
but,
we gotta
but
confirm.
That's the first
Go ahead,
answer.
Al. I'm stealing your thunder. You talk. Sorry.
No. That's no. Come on, Larry. This is both of us sitting down and chatting. And parenthetically, I mean, the two of us here are two. And I'll date myself. I'll be a little kinder to you. I mean, here are two old white guys on a radio broadcast, and I want to speak to that because. Because the issue for me, I mean, I have lots and lots of minority and African-American colleagues, and I thought about bringing them on the show today.
Always welcome.
And then I said to myself, I said, no, I don't want to do it for this show because we as white males have to stand up to the inequities of these situations as much as everyone else. And that's become symbolic and representative also. And again, I'm not putting either of us on a pedestal. All right, but solutions. One of the solutions is what we're doing right now is confronting the issues and the history and making that history more public and talking about the ramifications or the implications of that history. But here's some very concrete solutions. And I mean, some of these are tough, some of these are doable, but still having to require courageous conversations. All right, from a top-down perspective, here's a top-down, and then I'll do a bottom-up. A top-down. We've got an inequity, and we know this, well-documented, of educational funding in this country where our minority-majority schools every year are receiving $23 billion, with $23 billion dollars in less educational funding every year. All right, so that right there, there's a beginning from a top down. We've got a disparity in terms of the money, and then we've got a disparity even where the money is there in how the money is being used, because we have an equity and excellence issue sometimes at the district level. We've got to make sure that we're being, you know, equal, but at the same time, equal is not equitable. And so we have students who have greater needs, students from poverty, students with disabilities, and so on, and sometimes they are not getting the slice of the funding that translates into effective instruction, into effective strategic services and supports that those kids, again, the minority kids, the kids from poverty, the kids with disabilities, they're not getting their fair share. So from a national and state funding perspective, we've got inequity. But then at the local level, it's how we're using the money and then the access to additional money. Because in suburbia, which still exists, you know, our schools, many times our parents are adding funds to our schools for the extracurricular. And when you go into, again, very rural or urban settings where there is a lot of poverty, parents can't be donating a lot of money, time, and effort in terms of that extracurricular level.
That's right.
to give the kids more. All right, so one solution is let's finally deal. If we're going to hopefully finally deal with police reform, let's deal finally with this inequitable funding in education. So there's the first one. I don't know if you want to comment.
No, that's all right. Go ahead. Keep going. That's fine.
Okay.
Keep going.
All right, so let's go to the bottom and kind of balance this. So I was on one of my phone calls with my with my colleagues in an unknown state. I mean, and again,
unmentioned,
right. I mean, what I do is I help school districts who want to work with me get federal grants where I'm built into the grant so I can work with them for 3 to 5 years. So we can do some systemic things. All right, so we were talking about the opening of the new school year, whenever that's going to be. And, you know, we were certainly talking about the social, emotional, behavioral elements of the kids relative to the pandemic and relative to being in isolation and potentially relative to having lost relatives to this disease, and all of that. And how are we going to address this in the first day, second day, third day, first week, second, third week? Okay. And what I introduced, and this is a district that has very few minority kids. It's a rural, isolated school district. And I said, you know, we've got to probe to see how the kids have also emotionally or even just cognitively processed through the situations with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery. Okay, and I said, you know, I'm not saying put it directly in their face on the table on the first day of school. I said, but we've got to be sensitive that these things have commingled and we need to prepare ourselves to be able to support the kids. That's the short term. And then I said, in the long term, I said, we've got to be thinking about how do we help our kids to understand individual differences and especially minority group differences. And again, that's not to stereotype, but that's to sensitize and educate these kids, because at some point they're going to graduate and they're going to be either at a university or in the workforce interacting with multicultural colleagues. And I said, as an example, I said, for crying out loud, you know, we've got internet. We could be doing almost like pen pals, the old pen pals. I said we could
yes,
find schools in the inner city or other schools that have more of a diverse population, and we could hook these kids. And I was talking largely at the upper elementary, middle, and high school level. But part of that education can be with their now interacting with peers from different backgrounds.
That's okay? A great idea, Howie. I got to tell you, it reminds me, and I always do this, you know, schools all over the country like to link up and pen pal with, but technologically, schools in other countries. Okay, and you hear that all the time. You certainly know that some school in Duluth, Minnesota, also meets every month with a school in Beijing. Okay, and the kids laugh and talk and all that stuff together and find out how much they have in common. The missing thing is that we don't even do that with our schools, inner city to suburbs. That's what we need to do. That's actually even more important, especially these days. That's a wonderful idea. Okay, but the thing is, and this is both your first point and this one. And Howie, I got to ask you this because this is a tough question these days. Okay. Just like, you know, we've asked, and you certainly know this has come out last week, we have asked the cops, okay, to do everything. And that's one of the things when they say defund the police, they really mean reorganize the police and the budget, okay? Okay, because we have asked the police to do everything, and these people are not trained to be social workers. They're trained to be police officers.
Right.
Okay, and so they have to deal with addicts and families breaking up and domestic arguments and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because we don't have the other people to send out to them. All right, if we do, we can do that with educators too. They need to be more your psychologist. They need to be more. They need to understand the psychological and traumatic needs of kids. Different professional development. Then you talked about funding a few minutes earlier. Okay, and how we're going to do that. Let me ask you this question. We're saying we need to do all this, and believe me, I believe we do, but we know for a fact that school budgets are going to be cut tremendously because so many people have lost their jobs over the spring, okay? And the schools are going to have less money, so we have to be really creative. What's your thoughts on that in terms of the budgeting? And I agree with everything you're saying. We need to do this. The question is, how do we do it with less dollars? How enough?
Well, I mean, that is a tough question, and it's a reality-based question, Larry. But, I mean, the way that I approach it is really from a strategic planning perspective. And a lot of our schools do strategic planning. But again, they don't necessarily do it in the most comprehensive way. Because unfortunately, I mean, strategic planning is a science and it's applied to education. And what happens sometimes is people don't know the science, and so they become dependent on people who are helping them to do strategic planning who don't necessarily have the full kind of breadth of it. But here's the answer to the question. We can't, at least initially, and I'm not trying to be naive about this, but from a strategic planning perspective, you don't start with the money. You start with a needs assessment. You start with a resource analysis. You start with looking at what is working, what do we need to maintain, and where are the gaps. And you identify and prioritize the needs and the directions that we need to be moving toward, and then we fill in the funding. So that's the first part of the answer. We've got to identify and focus on the need. We can't sit here and say, well, we can't fund it, so we're not going to have the conversation. We've got to have the conversation and then worry about the funding. But here's the other point. It's not always about the money. Sometimes it's about the assets. And certainly money is an asset. But we have other assets in our schools. We have people who are working hard. We have technology. We have resources in terms of curricular resources and professional development and so on. We've got other assets. And sometimes in the needs assessment, we do a time and motion study. And sometimes what we find out, Larry, in the time and motion study is that we're devoting too much or sometimes even wasted time on certain activities that are not giving us a return on investment. And I'm going to give you an example. Some people are not going to like this, okay? All right. The once a month, especially our elementary schools, the once a month assemblies where we have a celebration assembly about character. Okay, and I'm choosing this one very, very consciously, okay? And I'm not saying I don't like them, and I'm not saying that they're not part of, you know, building the culture and the climate of the school, okay? But the deal is we're spending a lot of time in some of our schools on that activity. What's our return on investment, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great to celebrate the kids that are doing it, but in those audiences are kids that are not doing it. And sometimes what happens is my good colleagues, my administrators say, well, look, if we have the celebration that the kids that are not doing it are going to be motivated to do it. But the problem is that sometimes the kids that are not doing it are not doing it because they've never been taught how to do it. And the assembly is not going to teach them. All right, looping around again. Sometimes we do things in schools that are of good intention but are not giving us a return on investment. Yeah. And if we can reallocate that time to having some of the conversations that we're talking about right now in terms of race and culture and how do we interact and understand our brothers and sisters, maybe there's a bigger return on the investment that isn't financially implicated.
Hear, hear. And, you know, in answer to my own question, there's an old line as a sales object, and somebody asks, how much does it cost? And the comeback line is, are you referring to price or cost? Because the price is $10,000. The cost for not doing it is $2 million. In fact, it's inestimable, okay? And, you know, if you teach people about race and social justice, you are adding to their character. It's that simple, okay? And, Howie, I want to talk to you about something else here, and that was a great answer, by the way. Thank you. Okay. Minority educators, and I had Lavelle and Khalid on, was it Monday, I guess, okay, the two superintendents, Ithaca and Reading, PA, all right, as an example. They're both African-American gentlemen, and they're lamenting. They're trying to do the right thing for all their students, and they run great school districts, okay, and but they're having real, real challenges finding minority educators. They would like their kids, particularly in Reading, which is 84% students of color. Okay, they're really trying to find minority educators. Now, of course, that's impossible. So Khalid explained that they have the, in their interview process, they've set up a series of questions to make sure that the, at least the new people that they hire are ready to go with the move towards equity and all that, that they understand the need. That's better than it used to be. But Howie, minority educators, if I throw that term out to you and the need for them, if you see that, what's your thoughts on that?
All right, and again, in the interest of time, I'm going to bookend this. We need, absolutely, we need more minority educators. But, you know, teachers, we need more counselors, school psychologists, related service professionals from minority backgrounds. We need more administrators, okay? All right, and I'm going to go a couple of directions with this. We need to do that, okay? And I'll be outrageous, okay? What we have to do is, you know, we've got to certainly create a pipeline. And a lot of programs have created that pipeline, okay? But maybe we have to do some other things. I mean, and this is absolutely crazy. But when we need more special ed teachers or we need more administrators, if you need somebody in corporate America, there's a point at some point that you pay for it, okay?
Right.
In other words, the salaries are not necessarily equal. They're equitable because you're trying to recruit people, all right? So why, if we're going to potentially pay science teachers, special educators, and others more, why would we not, in this recruitment process, if it will work, recruit and pay African-American or minority educators more? Okay, and I'm just going to let that one sit there because that's terribly controversial.
Well,
But let's also talk
good.
About the fallout.
That's good. It brings the water to a boil. That's good. I like
well,
that.
Well, yeah, sometimes you need to do that. But let's talk about two related issues here. Okay? Let's talk about the fact that we have African-American administrators or administrators in waiting, and they often are passed off relative to getting the job 1, 2, 3, 4 times. So we've got equally qualified African-American administrators in waiting, and they don't get the initial job when they are interviewing for the first time. So we've got, again, the inequity and the bias right there. But then let's go all the way down to the bottom again. In the absence of not having enough minority educators, we've got to directly address the unconscious, implicit, and sometimes explicit racial bias of our educators. And again, from a racial perspective, but also from a disability perspective, from a multicultural perspective, and so on. And again, it's not to throw it all into one pot. I mean, we've got to focus on the racial bias. There's no question about that. But in the absence of having equal numbers of minority representation in our educational ranks, we've got to deal with that anyways, which is the same deal with the police force. So let's go back to there. I'm sure the police would like to have more minority candidates in their pipeline. But the deal is they've got to deal with that on the recruitment and the salary side of things, but they still have to deal with the racial bias that we saw relative to the George Floyd situation. So we've got to bookend this across the whole spectrum of the educational system. And I'm not blaming and I'm not calling out my white colleagues. Again, if we're talking about we don't get it. I don't get it. Okay? When I go to a Native American community, I've got to be educated on that Native American community. And okay,
that's right.
When I go into the inner city, yes, am I more racially aware than other colleagues of mine? Sure. You know, or perhaps. But the point is, I'm not an expert. I need to be educated because any number of times my own implicit bias, and I have to own this, I'm going to do things improperly or incorrectly in an unconscious, implicit way, and I need to know why and how and what I'm doing. People need to call me and feel comfortable calling me out on that. And again, that's the mindset that has to be in every single class in this country, every single school in this country.
You know, it boils down, I'm not tooting my own horn here, but it boils down to what I said before, which is confronting this. Okay,
yeah.
We have to get away from being shy about talking about this stuff. in front of people of a different race, different gender, whatever the case may be, and you don't talk about it in a consulting or a condescending manner, an insulting or a condescending manner. You talk about it just as it conversationally to bring it up and confront it. And that's very difficult to do, but we have to really do this. I mean, it's just incredible. And, you know, you said something at the beginning of the show. You said how the kids didn't have the right technology or the right access, okay? And I can give you a classic example of that, Howie. I had the Bronx High School of the Future, which sounds good. There's a nice school, but they are in the poorest congressional district in the country, okay? And they gave out the Chromebooks to all the kids over the course of the first week of the school shutting down. And they thought that might work until they found out that most of the kids, or a lot of them, a vast percentage, do not have connectivity
right.
to the internet,
right.
which is something, yeah. I mean, and how do we cure that? I mean, there were so many things that have come to light. The pandemic, okay, and I describe it kind of like cleaning the stables after a fire, okay? The pandemic's the fire, now we got to clean the stables, okay? And boy, what we found in the stables was absolutely unbelievable. There's all this stuff going on, and we thought we were there, and we're not even close to being there,
right.
wherever the hell there is. I mean, it's just it's just astounding. And you know what's interesting about this? I know you do this too. I talk to educators all over the country, okay? And they all have good hearts, at least the ones I talk to, and they all want to make things better. They all believe in equity. They want these kids to succeed. Like, you can't believe every teacher wants these kids in an urban or a rural or whatever setting to succeed, okay? And they fight. We are still stuck in the just moving so slowly ahead, okay? It's just astounding to me. And we've got to just, and I think the answer is we have to confront it. It is that simple. We just
right.
have to confront it. That's what we're all boiling down to here. We really got to get down to the nitty gritty. I mean, it's just unbelievable. We got to go in just a couple of minutes. How we sum it up?
All right,
let me
make one more point. Though. I want to make one more kind of.
You
connector.
Have 5 minutes. You
okay.
have 5 minutes. Go, 5 minutes,
okay,
you're on.
All right, I'm good. All right, but relative to that implicit bias, but again, sometimes it's explicit racial prejudice, all right? But one of the connectors is the disproportionality of students being sent to the office, suspended, and expelled. And we've had these data for 15 or 20 years, and we know that minority and especially African-American children and adolescents and students with disabilities are disproportionately referred to the office for discipline and suspended and expelled. And the bottom line is this, is that a significant portion of the, quote, offenses, that when a white student does that offense, it's handled in the classroom. And when an African-American or a student with disabilities commits the same offense, they're sent to the office.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you want to talk about racial prejudice, and sometimes, again, it's explicit. These are teachers who are, they're prejudiced. It's bottom line. Now, very small percentage, just like a very small percentage of the police, but let's recognize that the percentage is there.
Right.
But sometimes it's, again, it's the implicit bias where the educator is not really aware, and they're trying to do the best they can, but it's not the best that they can. So, again, a very direct implication of these things. This is not theoretical for me. Okay, I deal with this every single day as a psychologist working with schools. Even though I'm not an employee, I'm working with schools in long-term relationships, and I feel that part of my responsibility on behalf of the kids is to help the systems to see these things, but then to facilitate the process of change.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. You kept using the word, or just thinking about it, prejudice. And prejudice is actually prejudging. That's what it actually means. You're prejudging based on something wrong. And most of the time, you said it a minute ago, the vast majority of people who are acting in a prejudiced manner just don't know that they are. Okay? They don't have the facts behind them. Okay, and they don't know the situation, and we got to get rid of that. And the only way to do that is confront it and teach it and educate it. And this, I have to tell you, you know, I hate to say it because everybody knows I love the way teachers teach and how hard they work, etc. But we have missed the boat on this. Okay,
right.
We pretended we were on the boat, but we missed the boat. Okay,
well, and,
we
got
to get off the pilot boat. Yeah.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
And I don't want to end the interview on a bad note, but it's the same parallel with the police. Okay?
Yeah.
We do have some quote bad apple educators. Okay? Not just teachers. Okay? We've got some lousy school psychologists, unfortunately, and administrators.
We've got lousy everything in some cases. Yep.
Of course. All right. But what happens sometimes is the administrators are not comfortable calling out the bad apples, just like in the police. It takes a lot of time to terminate an educator, doing it through a due process, you know, format, but you have to still do it. And let's be honest, sometimes our teacher unions are protecting the bad apples, just like in the police force. So
exactly.
let's just not point our fingers and say, well, that's only happening over in law enforcement. It's happening every day in education.
Right, and it's the same thing. We ask educators, we ask policemen, police officers, I should say. Excuse me, ladies. Okay, police officers to do everything, and they're not trained for that. We need
right.
to change these systems. Howie, you're, as always, wonderful. Write us up an article for the magazine and the website. We'd love it. Want to do that?
Okay.
Do
yep,
it.
Absolutely.
You know you're always welcome. Okay?
I
and,
am. Thank
we,
you.
We just love that. Yeah. So we got to go. You take care of yourself down there. Okay? Keep
all
that
right.
mask on, my friend, down in Arkansas. All right?
All right. Be well, Larry.
Thanks, Howie. You too. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, pal. Bye. Howie Knopf, everybody, KNOFF, and it's tweets at Dr. Howie, KNOFF. And Howie's really a sharp guy. I really love having him on. And you can look up Project Achieve. Project Achieve. Just Google it, and it'll pop right up, and it'll tell you all the wonderful things that Howie does as he consults with the great educational solutions to school districts all over the country. And he writes for our magazine and our website. We really appreciate his good work. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org. Tweet it out at EduTalk Radio, and please go over. Join our consortium. It's free. We want your voice just like we want Howie's. ace-ed.org. I'm Larry Jacobs. Howie, thanks a million. Have fun down there. Okay, in Arkansas, I bet it's hot. It's going to be hot here in Maine tomorrow. 92 degrees. I got the air conditioner all set and ready to go. Everybody, thanks for listening.